My name is Joanna from Walton over here. Ellie, thank you so much for asking me. I'm very humbled and grateful today at the same time. I always say the same thing when I try to, is that it's such a privilege and an honor to share my story for a couple of reasons, but the biggest of which is that I get to remember what I was like, because I don't want to forget that. It's very important for me. And then I also get to talk about what I'm like today. And usually I get too wrapped up in what it was like because I get kind of like this vicarious thrill of reliving some of those wonderful times, I guess. But hopefully I won't do that. We'll see how that works. But, I was also this morning, I woke up thinking about character defects. I don't know why, but, and so I was reading Step 6 in the AA 12 and 12, and maybe some of you will read that because it was really interesting for me. But, and I guess I just had an OA birthday recently, so I think that's another reason why I was in a period of reflection about, what the year was like and my character defects and had any of them magically been removed forever and, gone off to the ozone, but sadly that's probably not going to happen. But what it was like, what really briefly was, I came into this world 2 pounds, 3 ounces. I was 3 months early. I was almost born on a bar stool. My mom was, she was at happy hour after work, which she loved to do, and her water broke, and she was like, oh my, this is not supposed to happen. And, I was born, and the doctor said, he's probably not going to live. So if he lives, it's a 50-50 chance, but wouldn't count on it because he told my mother that she had a daughter the year before me, and she weighed 3 pounds, 2 ounces, heavier than I was, and she didn't make it. So the chances that I would make it were pretty slim, and so she, she prayed through the night, and, I made it. And for the first 7 years, I was very sickly. I couldn't gain weight. But sadly, that mom laughed. And at 7, a couple of things happened. It was like the perfect storm. She got sober. She married a man who I didn't like. And I discovered chocolate and peanut butter. And those were the two things that became my Lord and Master. And, I say this not to offend anybody, but I talk about food because for me this is Overeaters Anonymous. And I have to remember it was chocolate. I have to remember it was Duncan Hines. I have to remember it was peanut butter. I'm not going to say it was some powdery, sugary, cocoa-like substance. I'm going to say what it is. That's just what it is for me. If it offends you, I'm sorry. I want you to pray for me. Pray for all the wonderful things, because I want you to rid yourself of your resentment. And pray for all the things that you would want for yourself, and then I'll have the best week I ever had. So I discovered these two things, and as I said, she married this man, and he, bless his heart, he really wanted me to be the son that he had lost in his previous marriage because of the divorce. So he wanted me to be this, car mechanic, jock, football star, of whatever. You can look at me and tell that did not happen. I did not play football at all. But he tried, and he would do everything he could to make me into the man that he felt he wanted as a son. It just didn't work out for him. I loved my mother. I had a very strong relationship with her. And I knew from a very early age that I wasn't like other boys my own age. I didn't do what they did. I didn't want to do what they did. Well, there's a few things I wanted from them, but he would take me out to the field, and he would say, "We're going to throw a football." I'm like, "Really? Seriously?" He's like, "I want you to go down there, far down to the end of the field. I'm going to throw this football to you." Now, I thought he said, "I'm going to throw this football at you," because I knew as that football came flying at me at 500 miles an hour, it was going to hit me and hurt. So he would throw the football, and I would just kind of step out of the way and let it fall on the ground. And we would do this for 4 or 5 times when he would get disgusted, and he would just quit. So that was my game. And, so that was what set that up, and it was just a push-pull for a lot. Now, I ate over him a lot. I had a lot of resentment over him. And he tried to take my mother away from me. I had a lot of resentment about that. And so I got to be, and my parents really did what they could. My mom became sober, and they started speaking at meetings. They were very well known and went all over the country. And so, but I knew that was my time to eat. So I would, you know, go to the store and get all these things. I would steal from my mom's purse. I would, you know, lie to the checkout clerk. I would do all these things. I would eat out of the garbage when they were gone. I would do everything I could to get my fix because I ate because of what it says in our literature. I ate because I liked the effect produced by food. I liked that feeling of relief. I liked that feeling of that everything was calm for the moment, that I could get through it. I could get through the bully that was down the street terrorizing me every day of my life. I could get through being alone because I was alone a lot because I was kind of an only child. And it wasn't that I had a bad life. My parents loved me. They did love me, even though my stepfather wanted this football job. But he did love me. He just did the best he could, and that was just it. So my parents really loved me, and they did everything they could to make sure that I was, you know, safe. And they also wanted me to be thin, and because they thought that was better. And so they would take everything out of the house. They would cook these absent meals of, you know, steak with all the fat trimmed off and non-fat cottage cheese and cherry tomatoes, and it was just the god-awful stuff of, you know, that I can remember. But they did what they could. They took all the sweets out of the house. But I was a liar, cheat, and a thief, and I would run to the store and do all these things. I stole, I got caught, and, you know, if you ever have gotten caught when you're a child and your mother has to come down in curlers, my mother was my mother, who is the vainest woman I have ever known, bless her heart, but to have her have to come down in curlers to get me out of this, you know, predicament, the look in her eyes I will never forget, you know, the shame and disgust and sheer, you know, anger. But I never did it again. But, you know, that was what I needed to do to get my fix. So I did all those things. I got to, I was 200 pounds. I'm 5'4 and 3'8, so I've never been any taller. Very important if you're 5'4 to have the 3'8. It's helpful. Of course. Because when you're 5'4, every little bit is important. So I was 200 pounds. I wore two outfits that I felt I looked good in. It was always about what looked good. I was very vain. I wanted people to notice me but not notice me because, and so what I would do is I would cover everything up because if I covered it up, I looked good for myself on the outside, then you would obviously like me. So, and that's what I did. I covered everything. I matured as a boy very early, so I had hair on my chest when I was probably in junior high school, and I was afraid because people teased me. So I put t-shirts on to cover that up. I put long sleeves on, and I put long sweaters on. And people say, God, it's 150 degrees out. Aren't you hot? And I say, oh, no, I can lower my body temperature. That will. I just did what I had to do for self-preservation on a daily basis. I wore, as I said, those two colors. I wore corduroys because, you know, they kind of hid things, I thought. And but my legs rubbed together in the crotch, and so it wore off all the corduroy, which so then you could see. It was really kind of a delightful look. But that's what I did. I got into college. I was 200 pounds. And through a terrible kind of a class, I found this, what I would call now a pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, where I finally realized that people were laughing at me rather than laughing with me. And because I just realized that, and now at that point, as I said, I was 200 pounds. I was now consuming 3/4-pound bags of M&Ms a day because you could put those in your pocket, put a handful in, it would dissolve, and you'd have chocolate in your mouth. And that was the most exciting thing for me. And it would take the edge off moment to moment to moment because all I could do was reach in, throw it in. No one really saw me eating with a wrapper. It had all these little great things. And then I got to the point where, this is where it ended, where hopefully, is that, you know, I loved the taste of chocolate so much, so I would, you know, my parents would buy that Nestle Quick stuff to put in milk, right? You would chocolate milk. But see, I liked the chocolate powder, so I would scoop it up from the bottom, and then I realized that I wanted that powder. That's what I wanted. I didn't care about the milk. That was just whatever. But I wanted the powder, and so I thought, how could I get this powder? And so I had this brilliant idea of the same. This powder was almost like chocolate brownie mix. And so I would go to the store and buy these boxes of brownie mix, and I would eat it with a spoon out of the box and chew it. But you have to learn how to breathe. If you breathe the wrong way, it's just brown smoke everywhere. And that happens many times. You know, you can choke it. So, so that's what I come to. Now, after I had this pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, I wish I could tell you that I went to Horizontus, but I did not. I just went on a 3-year diet. And it was probably the last diet I hope I ever go on, but I just stopped cold turkey, those, you know, the chocolate, and I was also drinking, you know, 2 to 4 liters of Pepsi a day. So I stopped all of that, and 3 years later, I had lost 75 pounds. And someone said to me, "Oh my God, you look great. What have you done?" And I said, "I've been on a diet." And they went, "Wow." And I said, "Yes, for 3 years. 3 years I've been on this diet. And I deserve to celebrate." Now, I knew I couldn't have chocolate and Pepsi. I knew I couldn't do that again. So we went to the store, and I bought vanilla cake mix and 7-Up. There it is. And I knew in the back of my mind I was in trouble, but, you know. So anyway, I know I was going down a bad road. So I didn't, but I didn't go to Overzonis, and I called someone. And here's what God worked in my life. I called someone to speak to his roommate, and he got on the phone before. He says, "Oh, before I guess whoever this guy's name was," he said, "let me tell you, I belong to a program called Overeaters Anonymous." And I went, "Oh." I said, "Well, that's good." And he said, "Well, I know that you've been struggling with your weight, and you know you've lost a lot of weight." And he kept talking about Overeaters Anonymous. I'm like, "Great." He goes, "I'm going to a meeting." I'm like, "Well, that's great for you." He said, "Well, why don't you come with me?" And I said, "No, I'm busy for the rest of my life and yours." Thank you very much, though. He said, "No, really, this is a great program." I'm like, I went when I was 12 and it didn't work for me. He goes, "Well, you're not 12 anymore." I'm like, "Thank you for putting that out." But I really, you know, and I'm hemming and hawing, and he's pushing, he's selling this, you know, really working it. Finally, my people pleasing kicked in, and I went. I said, "I'm going, but I'm taking my own car. I'll meet you there." And I went to a meeting, and it was Temple Beth Elam on Wednesday night, on July 2nd. And I went to this meeting, and all I remember of my first meeting was that the whole room was orange. The whole room was good. And it was set up for bingo, and it offended me. A whole room of orange. I mean, really, you couldn't have any complimentary color, you couldn't have anything else. And I don't remember, all I remember is that he introduced me to every person in the room, which mortified me because I wasn't going to stay. I was only going there for him. He introduced me to every person as a newcomer, which that really, I was like, started to piss me off. And I'm like, you know, resenting it big time. And so I stayed for that meeting, and I heard someone say their absence, I heard the speaker, I think, say their absence was 3 meals a day, and that's when I thought I could do that. So that's what I took as my absence. And I stayed. Only because I was like, I have nowhere else to go. And I'll just see how this goes. So I stayed, but, you know, I didn't really work the program. He appointed himself to me as my sponsor, which I was like, I don't need one of those, really. But and he said, I want you to call me every day. And I said, "Enough, I have nothing to say to you every day." He said, "I want you to call and check in." I'm like, "Really, I don't have anything. I'm really busy." He said, "I want you to just call and, you know, tell me how you're doing. Report the weather." So I did. I called him, and I'd say, "It's 6:30, it's 58 degrees out, goodbye." And hung up. That worked for about 3 weeks until he finally released me with love. And then the second sponsor came along. Now, the second sponsor was more like me, and knew about me before I even knew things that I was going to do. And the only reason I got this sponsor, I'm going to be completely honest, is because when I got into this program, I wanted to change it from day one. I thought, you just did this all wrong. And so I knew that there was got to be a power structure. So I'm searching around the front. And I found out that you had this board of directors. And I was like, that's it. That's where you have to do it. And you'd get on the board of directors and then be president and then change everything and it'd be fine. We all need some help. So I knew that to get on this board, you had to complete steps 4 and 5. And have a year. So I was like, okay, well, I knew this one, so I got to give him my info. I didn't know I could give it to anybody else, but I, for some reason, I felt I had to get it to the sponsor. So I thought, well, I'll get this sponsor, and I, you know, we got to the point, it was about a year, and I'm like, oh, I gotta get this done, you know. So I said, oh, I need to do this intro. He goes, well, come on, let's do it, you know, when do you want to come? And I made an appointment, then I got lost, and I, on purpose, and then I got off the wrong freeway, I was just a mess. And then, so finally I made it again, and I had been working on it, he kept asking about it. I'm like, oh, I'm working on it, I'll work around. Brilliant, you know, dissertation of this. And I finally get there, and I show it to him, I pull it out, and he goes, it's one sheet, it's a paragraph. And he goes, where's the rest of it? And I said, that's it. Beautiful. Nicely written. All, no grammatical errors. Typed up. Everything. He said, oh, no, baby. That's not how we do it. I'm like, well, that's how I did it. And he says, well, you must have more resentment. And I said, I'm only 21. Who do I have to resent? I haven't been alive long enough to resent anybody. He goes, no. So I think he pulled every shirt out of his closet and he ironed every single one as he pulled my inventory out of me verbally. Poor guy. And so as soon as we finished that, I was like, great, 4, did 5, done, don't need him anymore, stop calling him, just ignored him. And, you know, after a while, he just got tired of, you know, putting his hand out there. So I got on this board, and of course, as you would get on the board, no. You can't change anything on it. And at that time, there were some hardcore people on that board, and they saw me coming like, you have, like, that much abstinence. No, you're not doing nothing. So I sit on there for 4 years, still tried, didn't get anywhere, but, and I sponsored myself for the next 15 years. I didn't want a sponsor. I didn't feel like anybody really had what I wanted. I don't know what I wanted, but I think they had it anyway. And I played around with it, but I came to meetings, and I was abstinent. That's the best I could do. So 15 years later, I'm speaking at this meeting. Well, one was over there. And that same second sponsor who took me through the 4 and 5, I was speaking at this meeting. I finished. I think it was a fabulous pitch, actually. And he came up to me and said, I can tell you're not being sponsored, are you?
Yeah.
Like, really? Seriously? How dare you? But what could I say? I was like, no. He said, well, I'm going to sponsor you again. I'm like, well, I didn't even have to ask. He just appointed himself, you know. And something broke in me. And I was ready to be sponsored differently. And so I did call him. Not perfectly, but I did call him every day, and I was willing. So that's what recovery was like. How long do I have?
You've got 6 minutes.
Okay. And so, you know, that's basically what happened, and except that, you know, what I will tell you is the first 6 months of my recovery, let me back up a little bit, is talk about my spiritual experience, was that, you know, I got in and I became abstinent. I took my first commitment at a meeting. Service was always a big deal for me. Because I knew that would get me to the meeting when I wouldn't go any other time, any other reason. So I took this microphone commitment, and I went every Sunday night to the log cabin, and I took that microphone, and I dragged it in my car, whether the car was working or not. I was just dragging this piece of microphone. I did what I could. I memorized all the things that we say. God couldn't would if he were sought, blah, blah, blah. All the prayers. I took my chips. I was, you know, semi-honest as I possibly could about, you know, being, oh, yeah, I read that. Yeah, I read that. That right there. Yeah, I read it. I just kind of stood around the edge of the program for those first 6 months. And finally, all my friends were, recovering so gratefully that I came in with. You know, they're all fudging the rose, happy destiny. Ha, ha, ha. They're all laughing and happy. And they pissed me off. So, and I was defiant because they were all having spiritual experiences. They were all being so happy and they were joyous. And I'm like, whatever, liars. I don't think I did this on purpose. I might have, but, you know, we used to go to fellowship after meetings. And so what I would do is I'd go with them. And now they did, you know, they were all like very strict about their absence. Like, well, they have sugar and all this stuff. Well, I still ate recreational sugar. So what I would do is I would go to fellowship with them, and I order a vanilla milkshake, and because that was okay in my absence, and you know, I mean, they would just watch this vanilla milkshake come through the back of the room, and they would be talking to me, but they'd be looking at the vanilla mug that was going in my face, and they were just like amazed, you know. I think they were all just kind of secretly like, whoa, you know. And so, and that worked for probably, I don't know, 15 or 16 years, and then, you know, one day, you just never say things to your sponsor that you really don't want to do, because I said to my sponsor, you know, this recreational sugar, I don't know, maybe it's not a good idea. And he goes, why don't we not do it for today? I'm like, oh, I didn't really want to do that, but, and then it was like a week, and then it was like 30 days, and then it was 60, and then before you know it, it was, you know, why don't we not do it? And I'm like, oh, okay. And so, my spiritual connection, so I was driving in my car, and I was really angry, you know, defiant, because I didn't see, my concept of God didn't really exist, because I was never baptized, I was never put in any kind of organized religion. My parents thought about what I was going to be, and then finally I was like, oh, whatever, do whatever you want to do. So I did, and I thought, you know, God would love me anyway because of, you know, how I was. And so I'm in the car, and I'm like, okay, fine, I want you to show me a sign that you're there. And so I said, I want you to show me this big sign. It has to be big. So I'm going to, so I stopped the car, and the moon directly slid out from underneath the seat. And I'm like, nope, not big enough. So I'm like, okay, fine. I'm going to open up this meeting directory, and there has to be right here, right now, where I am. I was on Washington Boulevard, at the right in front of the DMV, and the Prayer Foundation was across the street, and there was a meeting at 12 o'clock. I'm like, okay. But, you know, I think at that moment, I was finally willing to accept that there was a higher power, and then it changed for me, and I was able to hear things for the first time. So that was kind of what I would call my spiritual experience. Now, my journey of that has been, you know, getting to know my higher power, because I didn't really know, I just didn't think that God would love me. And so it's been a long journey. But everything that that's ever happened to me in life has happened because of my higher power, and it's been better than I could have imagined. There have been tragedies in my life, don't get me wrong. I mean, the first year in my recovery, my mom was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And she was able to give me my first candle at a meeting. And that was magical for me, because she told me that someday I'll be able to walk into a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous, with my head held high. And I do. I do. And the funny thing is that she gave me a candle. And, you know, we thought this was hysterical, but she knew my love of M&M's, so she bought this huge 3-quarter pound bag of M&M's with a no single taste on it. Now, we thought this was funny, but you should have seen the air suck out of them. They weren't watching me, they were watching the M&M bag, where it was going, what we're going to do with it, you know, who's going to get it, where will it go? So, but everything in my life, I mean, I always say that, you know, things that happen in my life are because God wants them to happen. And that was because, you know, when I, about 7 years ago, I decided, oh, I think I want to go back to school. I'm going to just search on the internet. And if there's a program for online BA program in leadership, I'll do it. There was. Well, if I get in, then I'll go. I did. And I finished that in 13 months. I'm like, okay, if there's a master's program that I apply to and they accept me, I'll go. They accept me the same day. I did that. I'm like, okay, well, there's one more degree I could do, but I'm sure I'm not going to do this, so I'm going to try it anyway. And I applied to a doctorate program, and they accepted me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, God, this is what you want me to do. And I did it, and I did it every day. And there are times that I called my sponsor and I said, I can't do this. I'm not smart enough. And he said, God didn't bring you here to let you fail. Just do the assignment and call me when it's done. I'm like, but I can't do it. Just do it and call me when it's done. So that is what God has been like for me. God has been loving, and it's just been a journey for me. You know, I've just been as honest as I could possibly be on this program, and I wish I could tell you that at 27 years, every day I wake up and the birds are singing and everything, you know, Dorothy's out there, yay! But no. You know, some days, you know, I get up and I'm resentful and angry, and I call my sponsor and I say, I'm resentful. And he goes, well, that's okay. You can be resentful. What are you going to do about it? But, you know, it's been a wonderful journey, and I'm so grateful, and thanks for letting me share. time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. Please remember, if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. Okay. So. I can't restate that question. What's right there? I don't have any experience. Can I give you some experience, strength, and hope about doing service and principles before personality? Well, I can give you two phrases, the LA Intergroup Board and the birthday party. You know, I guess that's really hard for me because I guess one of my character defects is, you know, that I want people to do things as I would do them and to that level. So... that's just what it is. And so it's hard for me when people don't live up to my expectations. And so I have to, you know, and what I have to do is realize that they're doing the best they can. It may not be the best that I think they can, but that's irrelevant. They're doing the best they can. And I have to work on it myself because it's something that I see in them that I need to work on. It's just my perfectionism. It's my ego. It's my vanity. It's all of those things. And, you know, then I have to sometimes call my sponsor when I want him to tell me the things that, you know, the program things. There are other times when I don't want him to tell me anything. So I don't call him about it, you know, because I want to sit in it. That's just the honest truth in it. Sometimes I like my character defects, you know, and I want to be resentful at them. But I work through it. And then I'm like, oh, I can't live with this. I know what this is going to turn out to be. You know, I can't afford that. You know, I can't afford that resentment. I can't afford that perfectionism. I can't afford that pride. So I have to work through it. And I just have to let it go. And it's not easy. It isn't easy. You know, it happens at work and it happens in OA as well. And I just have to, you know, I'm powerless over them. My life is unmanageable. I'm powerless over my perfectionism and my life is unmanageable. I have to work the steps on it as best I can and let it go. And that's not easy, and that's the best answer I can give you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Could you talk a bit what you do on a daily basis for program, and if you find yourself sort of getting up on the wrong side of the bed, so to speak, how do you work to turn that around?
Can I talk about my daily practice, and if I wake up on the wrong side of bed, what do I do? Well, I would say, you know, there are several days that I do wake up on the wrong side of bed and I have to, you know, and the beauty of this is that, you know, before I would have to call my sponsor from home or when I got to work and I would forget or I would get busy or anything like that, but then a couple months ago I bought this new car and it had a Bluetooth in it. And that is the best thing for me because when I get in the car, I can call him from the car on my way to work and then it's like a no-brainer. And so I have to work through it, and I have to call him and be honest and say, I'm having a bad day today, I'm rushed, I'm feeling fearful, because it's really all about fear for me. It's really all about fear. Someone's not going to like me, I'm not going to do it well enough, and therefore I shouldn't do it at all, or they're kicking me off because if they did it my way, then I'd look better. You know, so it's always about that kind of stuff. And then I have to just be honest and talk to him about it. And then he like, okay, let's work the steps on it. You're powerless over this person at work. You know, whatever it is, it's like he just goes back with me through the steps. I mean, that's the only answer that he has. And he's like, where's God in all this? I'm like, I don't know. You tell me. You know, like, I want him to tell me. But, you know, I can tell you at over, you know, as many years as I've been in the program, it usually comes quicker than it did, you know, in the beginning. So that's basically what I do.
Can you talk about how you incorporate exercise in your program?
No. Exercise. Well, okay. I hate exercise a little bit. I just hate it. And sometimes what I have to do is call my sponsor and say, and get to be very basic about it and say, I'm committing to exercise this week. And the reason I do that is, you know, when I make a commitment to him, he says, which I believe this, it's like making a commitment to him and God, because I'm saying it out loud. And so when I say to him in the morning, I'm going to exercise, I'm going to be on the treadmill tonight, then I go. If I don't, and I get through the phone call without saying it, either because I didn't want to exercise and I knew what I was doing, or just because I know that I'm not going to, you know, that is what it is too. But I just do it on a daily basis. I don't do it perfectly. I get on the treadmill. I do the 30 minutes, an hour now on the treadmill. I try to do the machines. I mean, that's just basically the best I can do on a daily basis. So that's how I do it. I have to commit to it sometimes, because as left around devices, I'd be a flaw. Robin.
I want to hear your thoughts specifically in what you do with cravings for food or any particular clean bath that you know of.
What do I do when I feel the cravings for food return or any kind of character defect probably coming back? That's a great question. You know, I talked about the brown mix, and so that was like chocolate was like the biggest love of my life. You know, luckily I've been blessed in this program to have what it talks about in literature, where I kind of recoil as if, you know, from a hot flame with the food, but I don't have any fear about it. I don't have any little anger about it either. Like, I make these brownies probably a couple of times a month for people at work and for potlucks, and I can make it in my house, and I don't care. I can have it in my house. I have a candy bowl in my office, and it's always full of candy, and I buy it every week, and I fill it. People, like, as they're eating it out of their jar, they're like, how can you have this in your office? I'm like, it's not my food. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not. It doesn't call to me, because I know what that life is like. And so whenever I have those cravings, I know what that life is like if I give into them. You know, my mother used to say this all the time. She goes, Dave, you can do whatever you want to do if you're willing to pay the price. Mm-hmm. Whatever that is. You know, if you want to not exercise today, then I'm not going to, you know, I won't get the benefit of doing that. And when my character defects come up, they're very hard to get rid of, you know, in the moment, because I feel justified in having them. I feel justified in being, you know, resentful, prideful, egotistical, vain, all of those things, fearful. I feel very justified in having them. And sometimes I have to breathe, and my sponsor said, in that moment of breathing, I'm letting God in, and maybe I'll take contrary action. Sometimes I won't. I have to be honest. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I send that email because they deserve it. And then I'm like, oh, I should have sent that email. Sometimes I write the email and I don't send it. And those are the times when I think my higher power is taking care of me. But, you know, there's a mix of it. I wish I could tell you that, you know, I was perfect every day, but I'm not. And all I do is sometimes I have to just avoid doing it, so that, you know, if I want that certain food and I know it's not good for me, I have to say, okay, I'll have it in 5 minutes. I'll have it in 5 more minutes, in 5 more minutes, in 5 more minutes. Some days are like that. There isn't a magic answer, and I have to pray about it.
Thank you. The way you describe your three away food life, you know, the chocolate, the bread, you know, all of that, was, I can really experience it in terms of it being like a drug and it's taking you away, doing mm-hmm. what you needed it to do, that, you know, when you needed it. How do you go into that? I think you described it as awe.
Uh-huh.
You know, how do you get that feeling now? How can you feel that peace that you got from your drug in your life now?
So the question was, is with the chocolate and those substances, I used to feel that awe moment of, you know, that release, and how do I accomplish that now in recovery? Well, you know, it's about living this program. It's just, I mean, it comes from realizing that I can't be, you know, that was really being angry with myself, and eating those things to fill the hurt and the fear and the anger and all those things that were coming through. And now it's like I can't be angry and resentful at the same time. I mean, I'm angry and grateful at the same time. So I have to get into gratitude. And some days it's easier than others. You know, and so I have to remember, you know, I did all these things in my life. I accomplished a lot of things. I'm loved by people in this program. I'm loved by people at work. I'm loved by my family. And that's what gets me through. And it's like, do I want to pay that price of having that, you know, 30 seconds, you know, that release? Or do I want to have a longer release and live this spiritual life? And it really comes down to God. I mean, God got me to this place. You know, I should have been dead with eating all of that crap. I should still be out there or I should be dead. One of those two, I don't know. But I'm not. So I have to believe that I'm here for a reason. And to do those other things isn't what God wants for me. So I have to choose to live this life. Nick.
Can you
speak
a little bit about acceptance?
Hmm. Sorry, that corner of the room. you know, as you can tell, I'm not perfect. I keep saying that. And acceptance is hard for me. You know, I want what I want when I want it. I think I deserve it. I've worked hard for it. Give it to me or get out of my way. And those are some, you know, that's just how, you know, I felt. And I was brought up by a woman who, she got a lot of things because of who she was. She was glamorous. She was loved by a lot of people in the other program. I wanted to be that. I didn't want to be, you know, with the long nails and the hair and all that. But, maybe it is. Anyway, but she... You know, so I wanted to emulate that. I wanted what she, you know, what she got. And I thought, and how she got it was she was sarcastic, she was funny, she was a persona. She was just bigger than life. And she got things, and so I tried to get things that way. But I also felt like I deserved them. And so there are times when, you know, yeah, I don't get what I want. And I'm like, well, that's really messed up. That's not life. But then what happens is on the other side, I look back on it, and what I did get was better than I could have imagined. And, you know, you can't see that in the moment. I can't see it in the moment. I shouldn't say you. I can't see it in the moment. So in the moment, I'm like, I didn't get that job. I applied that. Here's the thing. Here's an example. I wanted to go to Wisconsin. I still do. I'm going to go one day. You guys are going. I'm going to go. But, yeah. But I wanted to be with my family. And I applied, 3 years ago, I applied to 80 jobs in Wisconsin. And I didn't get one. I got one interview, but I didn't pass the paper screen on most of them. But I was self-will. I was going. I was going to go. And I had to get into acceptance that it wasn't supposed to be. And sure enough, I stayed. I got into this doctorate program. I finished it. And then, you know, 3 weeks after I finished that, I got this incredible job that I couldn't have, and they just handed it to me. They said, oh, you've never been an administrator at this college. We're going to make you one. I'm like, whoa, okay, all right. So I had to get into acceptance that this is where I'm supposed to be. And it doesn't happen easy because I will call my sponsor today and said, no, this needs to happen this way today. And he said, no, David, it's not going to happen that way. You know, it may not happen for a while. You just got to get into acceptance. And that's not easy for me. And then he gives me grief to do in writing. All that kind of shit. So that's the answer. Carol?
Can you focus for a little on the 7 minutes?
Okay. Go ahead. Yes, I'm externally unique because, you know, as I said, you know, I deserve a lot of things in this life, and I think that I'm special. And they should just, you know, like I'm about ready to, the job that they gave me was for a year. And they said, you know, after a year we're going to create this permanent job and it's going to be a lot more money, and you know, I'm like, well, they should just give it to me. I shouldn't have to apply for it again. I've done it for a whole year. They love me, so they should just give it to me, and they shouldn't make me go through all the motions, and what if I don't get it, and then the fear kicks in, and, you know, but, you know, so, and I'm totally unique in that, you know, I think that other rules shouldn't apply to me. They should apply to you, but they shouldn't apply to me. And, you know, so, and if I'm completely honest, you know, sometimes I sit in that corner, and, I judge a little bit, and I talk a little bit, and I shouldn't, but I'm kind of like, well, the rules don't apply to me, but they do apply to me, you know, and I try not to do it on a daily basis. I try to be better at it, and I try to nudge the person next to me and say, I can't do that, but, you know, some days the term of uniqueness kicks in a little bit more, and you know, then I have to admit it to my sponsor and to, you know, people around me, and just try to be the best person I can. So that's the best answer I can give you. Ellie.
Thank you, Tony. Would you talk about the, your experience with the men's?
My experience with the men's is that, you know, as I said, you know, when I did this first inventory and I had a paragraph and I said I didn't have anybody to resent because I was too young, I realized that I did have a lot of resentments. And I did have a lot of things to make amends for. You know, I worked as an example. I worked for a hospital when I was like 15 or 16. I was a candy striper, volunteer, whatever. And I got to wheel the ice cream cart, you know, with little desserts and everything, through and give it to patients. But I didn't want them to have the ones that I wanted, so I would just kind of hide those and only put out the ones that I didn't really care about. And then I would eat all the ice cream and make all these great floats. And I, like, stole cookies out of the, you know, hospital. And I did all kinds of things. And I worked at an answering service, and I would, you know, it was the cord board, and I would be eating. You know, I don't know what you do for 8 hours when you answer. It was like the best job. And I'd be eating, and sometimes I worked the doctor's exchange, and when the phone was ringing, I would just say, oh, whatever. And hang up on them. How do you make amends for that? I don't know if they were emergency, hopefully I call back. But, you know, I mean, and I had to talk to my sponsor about some of those things, and we had to, you know, be creative about the amends. Like, there was a an amends where I had charged a lot of money on my dad's gas card, and then he died. Well, he died, and then I charged it, you know, because he was dead. They weren't going to come after me. We had the same name, but so what? And she died. So then I had to do a different amends. I had to, you know, pay Chevron a lot of money to, you know, do all that kind of stuff, and I had to make it. Some of the amends are still ongoing. You know, some of them, but I'm ready to make them. You know, and I have to be willing to make them, no matter how long it takes, and it may take to the end of my life. You know, some of them I've paid many times over. I've paid Apple Computer many times over for defaulting on a loan, many times over, from collections and all of those. So, I mean, some of those amends are just creative and different, but I'm still making them. So, are we?
Yeah,
1 minute. Okay. Yeah, you know, did I come to a peace with my stepdaddy before he died? You know, the piece is that I realized that he got robbed of having the son from his previous marriage. He had a son when from another marriage when he married my mom, and he never got to see them. His ex-wife said, I don't ever want you in their life again. And so what I realized with the inventories was that he wanted a son, and he wanted me to be the son that he lost. And I couldn't be that. And I kind of felt sorry for him. And I had to forgive him, because he just did the best he could. You know, he made a shirt that said, Presby Stepdad. I mean, he was just crazy. He just, you know, but he showed it in other weird ways. And you know, he always tried to be a father, even though I had a father that was alive. And so I just had to, like, say, you know, he did the best he can and love him to the best of my ability. Now, he died the day before my mother died, which was a totally unrelated incident. So it was a really bizarre kind of a situation. And I really realized he loved my mother so much that in that way, I could love him, because he loved her. So, and that's it. So thank you.